Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with experts on kids' nutrition and on the federal insulation tax credit for homeowners. Jay will also have details on some new film projects slated for Central Ohio. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
I have two grown children. When they were kids, they were very picky eaters. Their palates have expanded, but that didn't happen until high school or even beyond. Amanda Bleckman is a registered dietitian and mom of two young kids, and is also the director of nutrition and scientific affairs at Danone North America. She joins us now on CBIS Perspective to talk about kids' nutrition. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. It has been said for years that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Why is that?
Oh, we put so much pressure on breakfast. It's really that first opportunity to eat something and get started on a positive note for the day. But for me, breakfast on busy mornings is really about two things. I'm looking for speed. I want everybody out the door on time. And I'm also looking for nutrition. Just because we're being quick doesn't mean we can't put together a balanced breakfast. And actually, one of my favorite go-tos is a simple bowl of cereal. So it's really great. My kids love it. They get so excited. And you can pick more nutrient-dense options by looking for lower sugar cereal options, then pair it with some fruit, top it with a fortified plant-based milk alternative like Silk Kids, or use regular milk if that's your thing. I love Silk Kids because it has a taste kids love, it's developed with pediatricians, and it has nutrients that growing kids need. So it has protein to help support muscle health and also vitamin D and potassium.
Now, I grew up on cereal myself, but I got to be honest, I got bored of it. So what's the alternative to cereal for quick and easy but nutritious in the morning?
Great question. I really like to make things in advance, so that makes my mornings so much easier. I'll make a big batch of oatmeal bars, pop them in the freezer, and then just easily pull one out and warm it up whenever I need. You can pair it with a glass of Silk Kids and some fruit, and you've put together a balanced breakfast that literally took less than 5 minutes to make.
Should we be sending our kids to school with a packed lunch? And if so, what should we be making for them?
Oh, the dreaded lunchbox. It actually can be so much simpler than a lot of us realize. I like to follow a really simple roadmap. So a couple things. I'm looking to hit all five food groups. I'm making sure that I include a variety of flavors and textures so it can really taste satisfying. And I always like to pack something fun. So for example, today I packed a turkey sandwich for my kids. You get turkey from the protein group and bread, which is in the grain group. I packed some sweet grapes and crunchy carrots for our fruit and veggie. And then I added some Greek yogurt mixed with ranch seasoning, great for dipping those veggies, and a Danimal smoothie. What I love about these smoothies is that they offer calcium and vitamin D. These are two really important nutrients that growing kids need, but actually most kids don't eat enough of. And a lot of parents don't realize that. So I love that Danimals is making it easy to get calcium and vitamin D together in one easy package.
Now, not every school will allow you to bring in a lunchbox, so how can you teach kids to make good choices at the school cafeteria?
A lot of it happens at home, and a lot of it is how we model for our kids. So show them that you have a healthy relationship with food, choose a variety, offer a variety of foods at home, and slowly but surely they'll start to follow along.
Now, my kids always wanted an after-school snack. As soon as we got in the door, it was, "Dad, make us something to eat." What are some quick and easy, nutritious after-school snack ideas?
Totally. My kids come home ravenous, too. So I'm right there with you. I really love to make an afternoon snack board. It sounds very fancy, but it's actually really simple to do. And what I love about it is that I get to choose which foods I'm serving, and they get to choose which ones they're picking. So it can actually be a really great independence booster. And then you're hitting a lot of variety, which is something that, again, I think is super important for nutrition overall. So you can include lots of different fruits or veggies, apple slices, grapes, some dried fruit, cheese, and crackers and things to dip like guacamole or hummus. And also, I love these Too Good & Co. pouches. They are so delicious. They're made with real fruit, less sugar, and whole ultra-filtered milk. And they're great not just on the snack board, but actually from, you know, to go from activity to activity. If you've got a busy day, you won't miss a beat. For the little ones, I love Happy Family, Happy Tot multi-grain cookies. They are so adorable. They come in these cute little shapes. They're crunchy and fun and add some additional texture and variety to a snack board. And they're also really yummy to dip in the Too Good & Co. if you squeeze it out of the pouch.
Now, do you let your kids make their own snack boards?
If there's time, I love to get them involved and help me. If we're pressed for time, I'll make it in advance. It's really what works for you.
How do you get your kids, my kids, any kids, to eat vegetables specifically? And for some, they even have an aversion to fruit. How do we get them there?
There's lots of things you can do. I think, as I mentioned before, modeling behavior. If you're eating them, your kids may want to try them along with you. Getting your kids involved in the kitchen can be a great tool because when they're more involved in making what they're eating, they're more likely to try it. And honestly, just offering it, keeping it available, even if they're not necessarily choosing it right now, repeated exposure can help increase their comfort with foods that they may be learning to like, and one day they may get there.
How do you feel about including children in the harvest? For example, taking kids apple picking to introduce them to apples or growing their own vegetable garden.
It's great. My kids actually love getting involved in my garden. And in the mornings on our way up to the bus, they'll go and grab some tomatoes or some sugar snap peas. And I have to be honest, I'm not sure if they would have necessarily tried them right away if they hadn't been picking them themselves. So it's a really great way to expose them to lots of fruits and veggies.
Not to mention it teaches self-accomplishment, and it helps boost the ego.
Absolutely.
Which is extremely important at a young age.
It's a great feeling.
If we, as listeners, want to find more information on this topic, is there a simple website that we can visit?
Yes, you can find more information about the products on each of the brand's website and use the product locator. You can also follow along with me on Instagram at Amanda Bleckman for more nutrition tips.
All right, Amanda, thank you so much. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Columbus is becoming a hub as a movie shooting location. Last year, three pictures were shot in the capital city, with another partially filmed here. The movie Teachers used the old Central High School back in 1984. Now, four new film and media productions have been approved for incentives through the Columbus Motion Picture Incentive, CMPI, and three of those projects also received incentives through the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit, OMPTC. Acclaimed director John Doherty is at the forefront of the Columbus motion picture scene and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thank you very much for having me today.
It's our pleasure. John, with all the locations worldwide to use as a backdrop for a movie, what gives Columbus, Ohio a competitive edge for being chosen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of it has to do with cost of doing business here, right? If you combine the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit and the Columbus Motion Picture Incentive, you get an incentive package that becomes really attractive for productions. You know, the local incentive we have here is the first and only local incentive in the state. So we introduced it last year with a limited rollout. And again, this year with a little bit of a limited rollout, but hope to really get it rolling here. So that's it all, you know, as with a lot of things, it boils down to what it costs to do business.
And speaking of costs, on the other side, what are the gains? What is the economic impact to Columbus and Central Ohio when a movie is actually made here?
Yeah, sure. Another great question. So we've had several economic impact studies done. There was a statewide one done several years ago. We did a local one here about a year and a half ago. And for every dollar that's put into the program, we get to reap about $3, a little over $3. You know, you think about the trickle-down effect of a movie. Projects come here. You have quite a bit of crew come in. They need hotels. All the crew needs to be fed, whether they're local or from out of town. You have transportation. You have cost of building sets, renting locations. You know, all that stuff just becomes part of the ecosystem of the film industry.
What was the grant application process like? And what do these awards specifically enable for Columbus filmmaking?
Yeah, so the incentive process at the state level, you know, they're very fairly straightforward. They ask for your script, they ask for your budget, they ask for an estimated economic impact, and one of the things that we also ask for, both at the state and the local level, is you have to have proof of 50% of your budget is financed already, right? We don't want people to come in and get approved for the incentive and not use it. So if you have 50% of your financing in place, that's going to make the process a little easier. And then on the back end, to receive the incentive, after your project is done, you go through an audit process. That audit process is then reviewed, and we determine exactly how much you spent at the state level within Ohio, and at the local level, we determine how much was spent in Franklin and the surrounding counties. And you get at the state, you get 30% of that budget back. At the local level, you get 10% back.
Well, that should encourage a lot of filmmaking. Now, I mentioned the movie Teachers earlier. That came out when I was in high school. But what is the most well-known movie filmed in Columbus that we can think of?
Wow, that's a great question. So Traffic, portions of Traffic were filmed here. That was in 2000, I believe. Traffic was filmed here, Cincinnati, and other locations around Ohio. Little Man Tate was here. That's a very well-known movie. We're working on a film trail right now. There's an app called Set Jetters, S-E-T Jetters, and if you can download that app now and look at a ton of movies that were filmed here. You know, most recently there was a great independent lower budget movie called Poser, which got into Tribeca in New York a few years ago and was actually part of competition, one of, I believe, only six films in competition. So that was a great movie that was filmed here recently. And then literally just last night, I went to a screening of a movie called Down to the Felt, which was made here in Columbus last year by some great writers and crew and directors here in Columbus. And it's a great movie that'll come out. I believe it's screening. It's doing its festival run right now, and then it'll be screening at Studio 35 and at the Drexel in September.
So that's either about playing pool or playing cards. Which one was it?
It's about playing cards. It's a really great, kind of crime caper with some comedic bits in it. And it's a really good movie with some great actors in it. Highly recommended.
I can walk to the Drexel, so I'll just go see it there. Now, next question. Do you have partnerships and relationships with area high schools and colleges to encourage the development of local filmmaking?
Absolutely. So we're really trying to push animation these days. You know, animation is such a massive industry. We work with CCAD. There's a recent project called Gabriel and the Guardians, which is an anime project, which just received in this last round about a month ago, both the state incentive and the local incentive. So we are getting together with CCAD to see what kind of partnership that studio, it's called Colossal Studio, and see what kind of partnership CCAD can establish with them. You know, I work closely with OSU, and you know, there's some great other schools around the area. Denison is great. So and as far as high schools, every year we do a teen script writing contest. In partnership with CCAD, we provide two workshops for teens for free, age 13 to 18. After the workshop is over, we encourage them to submit a 5 to 7 page script. And then we pick three of the best scripts that were submitted, and we make those three scripts into actual movies at CCAD during their fall film class. So it's a great program, and we really like to reach out into the underserved neighborhoods for those kids and really give them an opportunity to write a real script and be taught by a college professor.
When is the Columbus Film Festival?
So Cinema Columbus happens in around April. end of April, I believe. So that's when it happened this year. As a matter of fact, Down to the Felt, the movie that I just mentioned, was the opening film for that, and it was a sold-out crowd at the Southern Theater. So that was a great experience. So that doesn't happen until April. And then there are other like smaller festivals throughout the year. There's a festival in October called Nightmares Film Festival, and it's by the name, I'm sure you can conclude that it's a horror genre festival, and it's become nationally recognized. But it's also a great festival.
Now, can any of these movies that were shown back in April be seen on a streaming platform, or do we have to wait?
Yeah. So Down to the Film will be streaming on Apple, I believe, starting in October. I forget exactly what they said, but some of them will. You know, it depends on what kind of distribution deal they have. So probably the best way to stay in touch and on top of that is to sign up for our newsletter at filmcolumbus.com, and we put a lot of that information in our newsletter.
All right, filmcolumbus.com. Write it down. We want to thank director John Doherty for being with us, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Housing is a major issue in Columbus. While new construction attempts to address a growing housing shortage, many individuals are living in structures that are twice, if not three times, as old as they are themselves. What constitutes construction standards today is not what passed muster in the 20th century. According to a recent Insulation Institute study, 89% of single-family homes lack sufficient insulation, leading to increased energy costs and reduced comfort during extreme weather conditions. A little-known federal tax credit could be the solution. Stacy Fitzgerald Redd from the North American Insulation Manufacturers Association joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss this. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
For beginners, what is insulation? What's it made out of? What does it do for a home?
So there are multiple different types of insulation. The most common type of insulation is fiberglass insulation. It is made of glass fibers that are spun and made really fine. And insulation is used within your walls to help slow the transfer of heat within your home. So that in that way, it helps keep us comfortable.
Why are so many older homes devoid of insulation? Is this a relatively new thing?
So, not relatively new. Insulation has been around, of course, for decades. The thing is that as we advance in our knowledge of building science and building codes requiring strict conditions are implemented, more buildings are being discovered as being under-insulated. So, for example, if you have a house that was built in the 1920s, chances are that there is no insulation in the walls. If you have one that was maybe built in the 60s or 70s, there may be some insulation, but it's not going to be nearly enough to make that home comfortable and habitable in today's climate.
So what is this federal tax credit, and how can we take advantage of it?
So the 25C tax credit covers 30% of the cost for insulation and air sealing materials, or up to $1,200. And homeowners can use that tax credit that would help offset the cost of re-insulating their home, particularly their attic, with adequate insulation. We know, as you mentioned, that 89% of homes are under-insulated, so most homes could use additional insulation. And that tax credit helps lower the first cost to homeowners of getting that work done to have their homes retrofitted.
Now, I've heard a rumor that this may also extend to HVAC systems, not just insulation. Is that true?
There are separate credits for HVAC systems that may still exist, but the 25C specifically relates to air sealing and insulation.
So what is the potential annual savings for the homeowner, and what does it do to the value of the home?
So homeowners homeowners can save up to 15% on their home energy costs if they add insulation to their attic and make sure their attic is properly air sealed. Because we know that electricity costs are going up and costs for just about everything are skyrocketing, it's really important to do what you can to help reduce those energy costs in your home.
Now, if you go through this process and then you decide to sell your home, what does it do to the value of the house when you put it on the market?
So the great thing about doing this work is research has shown that the more energy efficient the house is, the more likely you are to get a good selling price for that house. In other words, you could undertake this work and increase the value of your home. And it's one of those home improvements that really doesn't cost that much, but tends to deliver a great return on that investment.
And if we want to learn more about this subject and other ways that we can save money as homeowners, what is the best website for us to visit?
So there are a couple of websites. If you don't know how much insulation you should have in your attic, you can go to energystar.gov and click on how much insulation do I need. Based on where you live in the country, it will tell you how much insulation you need for your home. Another option is insulate.org. And that website will lead you to a database of contractors that you can find to help you do the work. And also you can go to our website, insulationinstitute.org, and click under homeowners and find a wealth of information there about all the details you need about insulation and specifically about this 25C tax credit.
We want to thank Stacy Fitzgerald Red for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The effort to redraw Ohio's 15 U.S. congressional districts took center stage last week at the State House. Redistricting is supposed to be done every 10 years after the U.S. Census. But in 2022, lawmakers passed a congressional map without supermajority support, including Democrats. That means it's only good for 4 years, so legislators have to do it again now. A couple key developments happened at the State House this week, starting on Tuesday. That morning, Democrats proposed a new congressional map. You can see how their map on the right compares to the current map on the left. They say their proposal creates fairer congressional districts based on voter preference over the last 10 years. It would create 7 districts that lean left and 8 that lean right. Right now, Republicans hold 10 of the 15 U.S. House seats in Ohio.
The principle is very simple. Voters should get to choose their elected officials, not the other way around. What we have proposed follows the law and gives voters the voice they deserve in their congressional representation.
That was Tuesday. On Wednesday, the map proposal led to a bit of a squabble. Speaker of the House, Matt Huffman, took issue with the Democrats introducing the bill before bipartisan discussions will start. Democrats are upset the speaker did not refer their redistricting map bill to a committee for public hearings. As I mentioned, the Democratic leaders introduced their map at a news conference Tuesday. Then, in the Rules and Reference Committee meeting Wednesday afternoon, Speaker Huffman said Democrats submitted the bill too late for it to be referred to a committee this time, but it will be up for referral the next time the committee meets. Democrats accuse Republicans of failing to advance what they call their fair constitutional map. After Wednesday's meeting, the speaker said Democrats jumped the gun by proposing it.
House Bill 442, which we introduced, which was the map the Democratic Caucus submitted, was submitted on time on Monday, and hopefully not off to a rocky start by us submitting that when the voters of Ohio want a bipartisan, fair process for bipartisan maps in the state of Ohio.
And the parties are supposed to sit down and try to come up with a joint proposal by the end of September 30th. Doesn't mean we still can't, but we're off to a bad start when the other side calls a press conference and says it has to be this or nothing else. So we intend to go through the process, follow the Constitution, and see if we can get to something where both parties can agree.
Now, political experts say Republicans would like to pick up two or three more seats through redistricting. Both sides say they are pushing for an open and transparent process that follows the Constitution. Their deadline to pass a bipartisan congressional district map is September 30th. The process will officially start Monday, September 22nd, when the Joint Committee on Congressional Redistricting meets for the first time. Republican leaders announced the 12 members Wednesday. It will be made up of 8 Republicans and 4 Democrats total from the House and Senate. Speaker Huffman says both chambers will have public hearings on redistricting this month, and the process will follow what voters approved in 2018, requiring fair political maps.
I think the main point here is follow this script that the voters approved. That's your guide star. That's what you're supposed to do. And when we get to the end, we're going to try to pass a map that is something that can be administered in an election in 2026. We'd like to avoid the problems, and I think we will.
And what do you expect from the Joint Committee's process, and how do you expect that to play out?
I expect for the Joint Committee process to follow the rules that were dictated by the citizens of Ohio in 2018 to make sure that they're fair, that it's public, and that we have maps that reflect the state of Ohio for who should serve as their members of Congress.
If the legislature does not approve a map with a 3/5 majority and 50% of Democrats supporting it by the end of the month, then the Ohio Redistricting Commission will try to pass one by the end of October. If that fails, it goes back to the legislature where only a simple majority will be needed. Ultimately, it could end up in court or in a voter referendum. Joining me now for a roundtable to break this all down are Ohio Public Radio and Television reporter and producer Joe Ingles and Cleveland.com and Plain Dealer Politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you both for being here today.
Great to be here.
Always appreciate when you come in. So first of all, Joe, with you, what's the big takeaway that you have on where redistricting stands right now based on kind of what happened this week?
I think we're seeing the battle lines drawn. I think we're ready for a fight. And it's showing that the Republicans are still going to have the upper hand, this not taking up the map, not looking at the Democratic map right now, and basically saying it's not going to work. They're kind of setting the tone for where they want to go with this. Right now we have the current congressional map is 10-5, but two of those districts that are held by Democrats were won by very small margins. So that map could be tweaked very easily. Mm-hmm. And, we could see this going into November.
Probably. Jeremy, what do you think? What's the takeaway for you?
Getting down to brass tacks, this is not going to be a process that ends September 30th. It's not going to be a process that ends October 30th the way it's going. This is going to go into November, and it's going to end with Republicans unilaterally passing a map that gives them an advantage in 12 or even 13, as you said, congressional districts. Particularly, they're going to make Marcy Kaptur's district in the
district
Toledo
nine.
Area.
Yep.
District 9, they're going to make that more Republican. They're going to try to make Amelia Sykes' district in the Akron area more Republican. And if they really want to press their advantage, they will try to make Greg Landsman's district in Cincinnati more Republican. Now, it's possible that they can come to some sort of an agreement and negotiate a compromise. They did that 2 years ago with the legislative districts.
Sure.
However, this year there's a lot more pressure on both sides not to give in, especially if President Trump has urged Republicans in other states like Texas, Missouri, and Kansas, for example, to really push and redistrict to create more Republican districts.
Yeah.
And on the other side, Democrats in California are trying to now redo their rules to allow for more Democratic districts. So the idea of a negotiated compromise now is far less likely than it was 2 years ago.
And Speaker Huffman did say on Wednesday that he has not heard directly from the president and doesn't expect to, but
well,
you know,
he didn't say whether he hasn't heard from other officials, so he said
right.
The president.
That's true. He was very specific about that. An interesting thing, though, is that the current map, the 10-5 map, was ultimately ruled constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court when it vacated the decision, the 4-3 decision from the Ohio Supreme Court that said it was unconstitutional. Is there any chance, do you think, that the Republicans would put this same map forward because it's already been deemed constitutional? Or is this, as you mentioned, still going to be an attempt to pick up more seats?
Well, first of all, the Ohio Supreme Court, which will be the first ones to hear this if and when there's a lawsuit filed, is significantly different than it was
now,
back then.
Yeah.
It's now 6-1, and the main opponent at the time was a Republican, Chief Justice Marina Connor. She has since retired. And it's widely expected now that the Supreme Court will sign off, basically, unless there's an egregious violation on whatever map the Republicans pass.
Yeah. Feel the same?
I do feel the same. I feel like the court it will be amenable to whatever they put forward. And, you know, the Republicans, they could just simply tweak the map that they have and kind of get the result that maybe they want.
And Speaker Huffman did say the other day that it's not looking very good that this would come up with a map that has Democratic support. And again, it needs supermajority, so 60% of the vote, plus 50% of Democrats being on board in the first round. And then with the redistricting commission, the two Democrats would have to also show their support or deem their support for it. You already said you think it's going into November back to the House, right?
One thing he's added, though, that was interesting, I think is going to be the bigger question, is if and when they go to November, if they can get one or two Democrats, peel them off from the House Democratic Caucus, to pass whatever maps they end up passing as an emergency. That would mean no referendum, Democrats have been talking about, because it would pass by a bill. You can go to Ohio voters and ask them to repeal it. Mm-hmm. But if it's passed as an emergency, which requires a two-thirds vote, you can't do that. And if the Republicans only need about one or two Democratic votes to get the 66 members of the House they need to pass that. So that would be interesting to see if they only need to get one or two, because I think, again, the likelihood they're going to pass something by September or even October is pretty unlikely at this point.
And the Democrats were very adamant on Tuesday at their news conference that they are going to fight. They're going to fight this time. They are not going to allow themselves, I guess, to be steamrolled in the sense of how this is playing out. So it looks right now like there's not going to be any Democratic support.
Well, it looks that way right now, but it always looks like that in the beginning. But, you remember last time when we had the legislative maps, the two Democrats who were sitting on the Ohio District Redistricting Board actually voted mm-hmm. for those maps. The reason they voted for those maps, they said they thought that the redistricting amendment that was on the ballot last year would have passed, and it didn't. And they also felt like they could have gotten a worse deal if they would have continued. But still, there were reasons that they ended up voting the way they did when they did. So this is going to come down to a matter of the Democrats figuring out, what works for them. And right now, they're all saying they're on the same page.
Yeah, and the Democrats put forward their map on Tuesday. The Republicans have not yet put forward a map, and the Speaker said he didn't even think that they would be able to do that by September 22nd, which is the first meeting of the Joint Commission on Congressional Redistricting. So do you have any expectations? Have you talked to anybody that says, when they might have a map?
I think it reflects that they are not very optimistic that something will pass by September 30th. So whatever map they will bring a redistricting proposal. But there's no great hurry because they don't see the need to bring one right away to negotiate, because it seems like negotiations are not going to succeed by September 30th. So it reflects kind of a pessimism that, at least in this first phase, anything will pass.
And do you expect it to be a fight in this redistricting commission once they do get together? We saw this squabble that happened this past week. The tone has been set.
That is such a softball question. Yes, of course there will be a battle coming into this, and I think we're going to see the battle ahead.
I didn't put any curve. Didn't put any curve on
that.
You
didn't put any curve on that, Doug.
Well, that's not the only thing that the legislature is going to be considering now that they're coming back from break. And one of the things that the Speaker also talked about was the possibility of trying to do more overrides of the governor's vetoes, in particular about property tax reform. They did override one just in the House in June, but there are others that are up for consideration. Is that on your radar as far as one of the big things that's going to be happening as well?
This fall, the legislature's not going to have a whole lot of sessions. Mm-hmm. They don't have a whole lot of bandwidth to do things. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the biggest thing left over from the budget when lawmakers went on break for the summer was property taxes. As you said, the governor vetoed mm-hmm. several property tax measures.
Yeah.
It's been a priority, particularly of House Democrats, or pardon me, of House Republicans and House Democrats, even though they haven't agreed on it, to deal with property tax reform in some meaningful way. This will be their first bite at the apple since the governor issued those vetoes, and they were unable to get the votes necessary to override most of those vetoes. And I anticipate there will be action on this going forward. There's several different plans. And, of course, all this comes in the face, the specter of next year or possibly the year after, having a statewide vote on abolishing property taxes altogether.
Yeah.
So there's a need in lawmakers' minds to do something about this without hanging over their
heads.
Well,
very much so. I mean, the speaker even said the other day, he's like, if that passes, if they don't do something and that referendum or that amendment passes come January 1st of 2027, we're in a whole new world.
Yes.
Is what he said. Like, what do you do if property taxes are abolished? Joe, do you see any other big issues coming up, or is this redistricting and property tax reform?
Well, those are huge issues.
Yes,
so
they are.
I think they're going to dominate what we're going to be seeing. But, you know, we always see all kinds of little pieces of legislation that, you know, kind of get controversial very fast and go away very quick. So I don't know.
The speaker mentioned that he was going to take a look at dealing with marijuana in some way, sort of the low-hanging fruit, such as banning minors from using it, some of the less controversial aspects of it. This is an issue where they've been negotiating for months over something, haven't been able to reach a deal, particularly between the House and the Senate, and now they're just trying to pick off some of the stuff that everyone agrees on.
Yeah, but that's, you know, they've been doing that for past in 23, and they've been saying that they're going to deal with it since 23, and it hasn't happened, so we'll see. I don't know what will come out of it. I think you're right. They'll pick off the easy things.
Yeah, just real quickly back to redistricting. They have said that they're going to start having public hearings on this, but the first meeting of the committee isn't until the 22nd. So they're going to have to shoehorn some public hearings in there in that final week of September. Well, Joe, thank you very much. Jeremy, thank you very much. As always, always appreciate your insight as you guys have been covering the Capitol and State House politics for a long time. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
You're
so welcome.
Parenting is hard. Technology can make it harder. The Family Media Plan developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics helps make it easier. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan to create the media plan that's right for your family. Whether you make a full plan or just choose a few parts that matter the most to your family, healthychildren.org/media plan is an easy-to-use tool that will help your family set media priorities and create healthy digital habits in line with your family's values. You'll also get practical tips to help make the plan work. And you can come back to revise your plan as often as you need to, like at the beginning of each school year or during summer and holiday breaks. Raising kids in the age of screens is easier when you have a plan. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan and make your plan today.
This is a dark moment for America.
That was President Donald Trump speaking from the Oval Office after father, husband, and conservative political activist Charlie Kirk was shot and killed. The shooting happened during an event at Utah Valley University Wednesday with 3,000 people in attendance. Kirk was just 31 years old. He was married and the father of two young children. Kirk founded Turning Point USA, an organization for young conservatives. He was known for inviting and engaging in political debate on college campuses. Reaction poured in from across the country almost immediately. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle posted on social media. President Trump posted on Truth Social, saying in part, "No one understood or had the heart of the youth in the United States better than Charlie." Former President Joe Biden posted on X, saying there is no place in our country for this kind of violence. Former President Barack Obama called the shooting despicable and said it has no place in our democracy. And Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said Fran and I are shocked and saddened by the shooting of Charlie Kirk in Utah. Political violence is completely unacceptable anywhere and at any time. I also had a chance to catch up with Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno. He says he's thinking about Kirk's grieving wife and two young children who don't have a dad now. He says Kirk was a loving husband and father. Moreno says Kirk will be tremendously missed, but his organization, Starting Point USA, will endure and they will grow it even more. Moreno wants to build on Kirk's legacy here in Ohio.
I'm going to encourage colleges and universities in Ohio to have Charlie Kirk speaking series where they have people that come in from all sides so that students have access to a wide variety of ideas and thoughts. And these ideas can be debated aggressively, but not with anger and certainly never with violence. I think that's the enduring legacy that Charlie would have wanted. And I know he's up in heaven looking down and seeing the tributes that are being made to him. And we're going to miss him, but his voice endures, and he made a big difference in this country.
Marino says Charlie Kirk came to him 10 years ago or more as he was raising money to start his organization. Marino says he wrote him a small check by today's standards to help with the cause and says he's proud of what Kirk was able to accomplish in getting young people engaged in politics and the future of the country. Ohio State freshman political science major Elizabeth Anderson shared this perspective.
This is absolutely devastating. I'm extremely sympathetic for his family. And everyone who was a supporter, of course, but I just think that we both need to, like Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, need to take a look at the other side and understand what's really going on, and that it's not just about the death, but it's about a much bigger, deeply rooted issue.
And what is that bigger, deeply rooted issue?
Gun violence in America.
And of course, 10TV will continue to cover the latest developments in the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.